Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has delved into one of the darker hollows of the internet today. Today, the term troll in internet communications can mean anything from a contrary dissident commenter on an opinionated website to non sequitur LOL cat pics to Rick Rolling, where individuals are redirected to a clip of Rick Astley's 80s song, Never Gonna Give You Up, to a far darker place where troll behavior seemingly derive pleasure from mocking the grief of memorial pages or spawning internet hoaxes following a mass shooting event that explains the perpetrator motives, which then gets repeated on traditional media, or expressing incredibly racist and sexist thoughts on internet sites. Whitney Phillips is an assistant professor of literary studies at Mercer University who entered this trolling community to understand the motivations and reasons for the self-proclaimed trolls' actions. Her book, This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture, examines a number of internet troll behaviors in detail and forms the basis for her talk this evening here at the University of Tulsa. LOLing at Tragedy, Facebook Trolls and Memorial Pages. She'll be speaking on that this evening at 7 o'clock in Tyrrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Whitney Phillips, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I have to ask you, what piqued your interest in investigating what you call a trolling subculture? This is this thing on the internet where it's oftentimes vile comments, it's comments designed to inflame a passionate reaction, whether it be rage or hurt or just an emotional response of some sort. What interested you in this behavior?
Well, I was originally brought into that space when I was starting very, very early research for my PhD dissertation, which at the time I assumed was going to be on political humor. And because it was 2008 and that sort of thing was going to unfold on the internet, I was spending more and more time, you know, observing what was going on these different political forums. And I kept coming across different turns of phrase and images that started to present themselves as being fairly consistent, that there was something that was happening that lots of people were doing. I didn't know what to call it. I didn't have a name for it. But it was clear that it wasn't traditional political humor. There was something more barbed about it. There was an irony to it or a distancing or something that was really strange and disorienting. Simultaneous to that, my brother, who was 18 at the time, he kept pushing me to check out the 4chan's B-board, which he said, you know, I would really like. He was trolling me. I didn't realize it until after the fact, but he was trolling me with that. So he kept saying, oh, yeah, it'll be fun. You should go check it out, you know. And so I started doing that only because I was already sitting at the computer all day. And then I started to see this overlap between these very confusing political behaviors or politicized behaviors, political joking, and then what I came to understand to be trolling subculture. So it was those two things together, and I was just confused. I didn't know how to describe it. It was interesting to me because I didn't know what to say about it. I didn't know how to characterize it. I didn't know how to situate myself morally and ethically to a lot of what I was seeing, and that was intriguing.
I think the definition of troll is one that you said that it's really hard to define. I think you said it was, as Potter Stewart said, in an obscenity case, you know it when you see it. But what is trolling? Because you'll hear a lot of people called trolls, say on a political website. If you disagree with the political philosophy of that political website, you'll get called a troll. But really, from what I can see, trolling is a deeper and darker subculture than just infiltrating a political environment with contrary opinion, a vehement contrary opinion.
That's an excellent question. It is involved. The answer is involved. So trolling was first used in the 80s and 90s on Usenet boards, discussion boards. And troll was a word that you would call someone else who was being disruptive or annoying. It was kind of a blanket accusation that you would call somebody else that term. In the early mid-2000s, the term started taking on these self-identifying connotations that people started to describe themselves as trolls. The people who were doing so were affiliated with or were engaging with content that was either on or popularized by 4chan's B board. B is in the letter B. It stood for random. Mm-hmm. 4chan was a simple message board. It still is a simple message board. But on that site and around that site, which created countless memes. I mean, many of the memes that you think about when you think of internet memes these days, lolcats, whatever, started in this space. And so these people who were engaging in these highly stylized linguistic and behavioral practices were all starting to call themselves troll, and it had a particular meaning. And as this group of people started to engage in more and more sensationalist behaviors that got covered more and more frequently by the media, this particular sense of troll started to take on traction. That's just kind of where the subculture comes into the conversation. Now, in subsequent years, with even more media coverage and even more people using the term, the word has become more and more unwieldy. And so in 2009, when I was in the midst of early research, trolling really only meant one thing. It meant this subcultural thing. It meant that person identified as a troll and were engaging in all of these stylized behaviors in consistent, predictable ways.
Being disruptive to a online conversation, commenting outside of the norm of the comments?
But doing so in a particular way, utilizing certain turns of phrase or certain images that in 2008, 2009, 2010, you could look at the comment section of a particular message board or blog or whatever, and you could tell when subcultural trolling was happening. They would use subcultural calling cards. There was nothing else that those behaviors could be. It wasn't just people being obnoxious. They were declaring themselves to be obnoxious to kind of signal their own membership in this group to other members of the group. So it was actually quite easy to pick out as a researcher. But as the term started to become more and more popular, it actually has reverted back to the original meaning. So now people use it to describe all stripes of problematic behavior, people who are just being annoying, people who are just being racist. And because meme culture, too, has exploded, people who are not trolls also use a lot of memes and use a lot of trolling in jokes and turns of phrase. And so as a researcher now, it is not possible to look at a comment section or, you know, you can't discern subcultural trolling in the way that you used to be able to do. And so now it's kind of this crazy free-for-all, which, you know, it's actually more in line with what the term used to mean back in the 80s and 90s. It's very different than the specific behaviors that I describe in the book.
So where did this subculture come from? Was it just sort of convergence of people finding, from what you say, you know, this whole troll identity is this sort of, I'm going to be disruptive, I'm looking for a reaction, anger would be great, and I'm going to take lots of pleasure from provoking this behavior for the laugh value that I'm getting at creating this emotional reaction. And it could be extreme emotional pain.
Mm-hmm. Trolling subculture borrows a lot of its aesthetic and language from sort of early geek cultures. I mean, although there's a lot of crossover between behaviors on, you know, Usenet boards, which was also sort of a kind of a precursor. The best way to describe it is like a precursor to Reddit, where people would post anonymously or pseudonymously. And some of the conversations could be really inappropriate, and the jokes could really get out of control. And so trolls are in that lineage. They certainly are not, these are not new behaviors. But what changed, especially in the early mid-2000s, is that the media landscape overall started to shift. And it went from more kind of traditional journalism. You know, you had newspapers and you had TV broadcasts, right, that it wasn't very interactive.
All of a sudden, they discovered the internet.
Yeah, all of a sudden, they discovered the internet, and that was very disruptive to traditional media. And so suddenly, you have a web-based media landscape that's click-based, right, that advertisements are garnered based on the amount of engagement that these different, you know, sites could gather. And so there was actually this incentive to post, you know, as quickly as you can, and often the most sensationalist content that you can. And trolls sort of harnessed this shifting media landscape to their own ends, that they recognized that these different outlets were going to respond quickly and extremely to really sensationalist, outrageous behavior. So trolls were sort of piggybacking on just natural changes, organic changes that were happening within the media industry as a whole. And the worse they behaved, the more coverage they got. And then the more coverage they got, the more incentive there was to keep doing what they were doing. And so you really can't talk about trolling, subcultural trolling, without thinking about the economic component to the conversation, that they are sort of benefiting from and harnessing and exploiting ad-based revenue systems. You know, if you are making your money based on how many eyeballs are on your page, that's going to incentivize certain kinds of stories. And trolls were brilliant at taking advantage of that and really spinning that so that they got maximum exposure.
Yeah, but in their case, it really wasn't for the profit motive, was it? It was just that sort of publicity within their subculture.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where, so in the book, I talk about the ways in which sensationalist trolling behaviors are often very similar to and sometimes indistinguishable from media sensationalism. The difference, so the behavioral similarities are there, that both camps, both sides are engaging in the most outrageous behavior possible to generate the strongest reaction possible. That where they differ is that the media outlets, they're looking for eyeballs, which translates into advertising revenue, money. They want money. But trolls are motivated by what they describe as lulls, L-U-L-Z, which is a corruption of laugh out loud or lol. And that, for trolls, lulls indicates that they have incited a strong negative reaction in whatever target. So they've made somebody angry. And they kind of, they talk about lulls almost as a kind of currency, that there's something that you want to amass. The more you get, the better, you know, the better you've done as a troll. And so both sides, they may not be motivated by the exact same things, but this amassment of eyeballs, and you want the most invested eyeballs possible too, right? That kind of bland eyeballs are not worth very much to media or to trolls. You don't want disinterest. You want interest. And sometimes the fastest way to get someone interested is to make them angry or upset.
And what you point out in the book is there were all these incidents where you would see the media turning to trolls as a news source. For example, 4chan B-Board, probably 99% of our listeners have no idea what we're talking about. You know, it is a board where these guys hang out and sort of say, oh, here's what we're doing. And so news media goes there and says, look at this outrageous stuff that is on this board, publicizing the board. The trolls take delight in that and pile on and sort of add to this sort of flame. It's like a vicious circle, wasn't it?
Yeah, I describe it as cycles of amplification in the book. And there are years of examples that I could cite. Some recent examples that are quite disturbing and very upsetting for me personally and for, well, anybody who's paying any attention, is that for years, one of the things that trolls on the B-board have consistently done is anytime there is a mass shooting, particularly at a school, they will somehow make it seem like they try to take credit for it. They start a hoax of, you know, the shooter was posting on 4chan's B-board the day before. And after every single shooting, there's been this narrative that then the media picks up on. And then suddenly it becomes this conversation of let's pore over every, you know, let's try to figure it out, get to the bottom of whether or not the shooter actually posted to 4chan's B-board. And in every case, it's not yielded anything. But it's this story that gets replayed over and over and over. And I have high regard for members of the media, and I think that in many cases, people are aware that these hoaxes are playing out as they did before, but it's news to report. And so instead of ignoring the story, which frankly, personally, is the appropriate thing to do because that gives the shooter less attention, which is all they want, instead of doing that, it's a point of conversation that comes up after every single shooting, every single shooting, and every time it happens, you know, I mean, I have on my blog, I have a whole, and it's so upsetting that this is the case, but five or six examples after all these different shootings of the same story being told every time and the media buying it in the same exact way and reporting on it in the same exact way. And you'd think that after the first or second time, like, that would no longer be such an issue. So that's very frustrating to watch unfold, but it's highly representative of the ways in which trolls and media outlets, sensational media outlets, amplify each other's behaviors. And so they're embedded in this weird relationship where one ends up benefiting from the misbehavior or, you know, the outrageous behaviors of the other, that they really, trolls in particular, they need the media to do this. They need sensationalism or else what they do is meaningless. And they would have no reason to continue doing it.
And I also gather that part of it is they know that there's some shoddy reporting of the moment going on, that they're going to latch onto whatever thing's out there. And so they're willing to provide that.
Exactly. And I want to be careful not to impugn journalists as a totality.
They're shoddy reporting.
There absolutely is shoddy reporting. I don't want to make blanket statements. But I think that one of the things that happens is that you know, there are structures in place at different news organizations, and that even if an individual reporter doesn't really want to report on a story, they've got editors to answer to, and those editors have advertisers that they've got to deliver for. And so you have a system that propagates maybe less than scrupulous approaches to media content. Nobody's a bad guy, but it's just the system does not lend itself to thoughtful, careful, slow, and nuanced responses.
Well, in breaking news situation especially, the controls that are in place often break down because of the nature of the event. It's unfolding, and oftentimes in a 24/7 live situation, things do get reported that don't get properly vetted. And again, this behavior sort of takes advantage of the breakdowns of those controls.
Right. And then you add social media to the mix. And so it's not just that you have a 24-hour news network that needs to keep content flowing all day long.
You have a 24/7 social media network.
Yeah. Well, and you need to beat Twitter.
Yeah.
That's the goal. And the problem with that, when you try to beat Twitter, when you try to beat Facebook, when you try to break stories, it's really easy to get things wrong and then to spin a narrative in a direction that can be damaging and dangerous, and then just as exploitative as the trolls' behaviors. So the social media space and the new, you know, the click-based web economy and social media generally, it does not always yield the most nuanced reporting, especially directly following a tragic event.
My guest today is Whitney Phillips, an assistant professor of literary studies at Mercer University and author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, which that title of the book actually comes from one of those crazy cat pictures, memes that you see on the internet. That's the name of the book, the subtitle, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. She's going to be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Turrell Hall Auditorium, sponsored by the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities. On, I still refer to it as LOL instead of LOL, LOLing at tragedy, Facebook trolls, and memorial pages. And that is really one of the, to me, it's kind of evil spirited that trolls will often go to memorial pages and say there's, you know, say a suicide, and they'll say, you know, this horrible language of like, you know, how's it hanging, you know, or, you know, just horrible, horrible language. But you went into this culture. You tried to get into this culture and infiltrate this world of trolling. How did you get into it, and how did you get their trust? Because one of the things you discovered is there's this huge disconnect between online and offline behavior among at least the people you spoke with, right?
They make that argument, yes, that for them—
You don't necessarily see it that way?
Not necessarily, no, and even less so now in subsequent research that I've done. I mean, there's a natural and necessary connection between what people do on the internet and who they are as people, that everybody is situated in their particular lives, right? And this idea that you could ever really divorce yourself from your own experiences, from your own body, I think that that's a really erroneous, problematic assumption. And what trolls do, what they tend to do, is that they assert that they can, and they feel privileged to do so, that they don't have to, their online behavior in their minds does not need to align with who they are as people. They get to pick and choose what they are actually attached to and what they publicize. And ironically, they end up targeting and antagonizing people based on precisely the things in themselves that they refuse to, you know, they refuse to publicize, which is what they actually feel. How their bodies, you know, how their lives impact their online behaviors. So I think that for them, that's one way, creating this firewall between, you know, who they are, who they feel they are, who they would like to be, and what they do online, that firewall means that they don't have to take full responsibility for their behaviors. And I think that that's a really important psychological step that needs to be taken in order for them to justify it, because the behaviors are often, I mean, and to be fair to them and also to be thorough, there's a huge spectrum of trolling behaviors, that some of them are, you know, I don't want to say harmless if they end up doing harm, but are intended to be sort of playful and not in themselves malicious, that it's silliness. Some of them are just silly, right? Mm. Doesn't mean that silly can't be extremely offensive to some people, but, you know, it's not coming from a place of hatefulness. Just sort of mischievousness, right? And it can travel all the way from that to the far end of the spectrum, which is outright harassment and hate speech in a lot of cases. And memorial page trolling in particular, you know, a lot of it was aimed at friends and family of the recently deceased, but a lot of it was also aimed at what they described as, quote, grief tourists. So people on Facebook who are getting really invested in the deaths of people they had never met before. And trolls took issue with that and said, you know, you shouldn't be showing emotion online. We're going to punish you. This is what you get, and maybe next time you'll know better. So they don't always just go after, you know, the people who knew the person who died, but still their behavior can be seen by them. It's all very fraught, although there's a huge spectrum to take into account.
And I assume that they're not targeting people they know or interact with in any way. There's sort of this complete anonymity in this process, right?
I think that there needs to be. And one of the things, I mean, that's what undergirds the firewall, that you can only really create a perfect division between your online and offline life if you're not engaging with people you know on the internet. So it's really hard. It's hard to know with absolute certainty because a lot of the behaviors are anonymous. But I would be shocked if a vast majority of trolling was directed at people that the trolls actually knew. I just don't think that's not
that's
the MO.
A distinction that's, between cyberbullying and trolling?
I think so, yeah. I mean, so in the beginning, especially in the United States, when these behaviors first started to become prominent, the media often referred to trolling behaviors erroneously as cyberbullying. And cyberbullying implies, at least as I understand it, the way that I distinguish those two things is cyberbullying is that you're bullying somebody that you know. You're being bullied by someone that you know. It just takes place in the digital space, which has different implications, right? Because it can be search indexed and amplified. So it's different than regular bullying, although it follows the same pattern. It's just Google search indexed in a way that in-person bullying is not. Trolling, on the other hand, it tends to be about causing the most amount of disruption within a group of strangers as possible and then getting out. And then you basically throw a match into the kindling and then you sort of walk away whistling. That's more what trolling is about.
I want to talk a little bit about the subtitle of your book, which is this relationship between online trolling and mainstream culture. Is this coming from our mainstream culture and sort of manifesting itself?
So one of the things that I have encountered most frequently in doing this research is that people, their immediate response to trolls is, well, what's wrong with them? There must be something terribly wrong with trolls to be able to engage with this, especially the really problematic behaviors, the memorial page trolling in particular. And I'm not denying that the behaviors are really terrible, but I think that it is a mistake to assume that trolls are the aberrant ones, that trolls are the ones that have the problem and everybody else is totally innocent. And therefore, by that logic, if only we could find a way to get rid of trolls on the internet, then suddenly we would have an equitable online space. There would be no more racism, no more sexism, and everyone would get along. And that's not true. And the title of the book, This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, that's a nod to the fact that most people assume that trolling is why we can't have nice things. And my argument in the book is that, boy, we would be lucky if that were true. If trolls were the problem, it would be a fairly straightforward solution. But the issue is that trolling behaviors that are very similar to trolling behaviors or analogous behaviors to trolling, those exist in spheres outside of trolling on the internet. They exist in day-to-day, you know, offline interactions. That trolling behaviors are the reason that they're upsetting and the reason that they're problematic is not because they're aberrant, but because they're actually quite common.
They're like snarky and snide remarks taken to the nth degree?
Well, that and also trolling is embedded within and draws from a lot of culturally sanctioned tropes, particularly around highly antagonistic male-gendered speech and rhetoric. So this impulse to dominate your opponent, to fight, to humiliate, this idea that, you know, when you are engaging with someone in an argument, the goal is to destroy them. It's to win, right? That's how we talk about arguments, that we talk about arguments using war metaphors and sports metaphors, right?
And we use sports metaphors for wars
exactly.
And war metaphors for sports.
Exactly. And so there's within the culture, there's this impulse, this normalization of a certain kind of rhetorical violence, and that violence is almost always conducted against what's regarded as sort of female gendered. So you have logical, you have rational, you have the kinds of strategies that are going to get you to win the argument, destroy your opponent, versus emotion, versus sentimentality, versus weak or soft arguments.
Finding
right?
consensus.
Exactly. So the female gendered communicative qualities get dominated and pathologized by these highly male-gendered qualities. And so trolling is not the only arena where you have a group of people who are trying to destroy with logic. That's taught in college classrooms. You know, this antagonistic rhetorical style is a hallmark of the Western canon, the Western philosophical canon. And so we see, when we see it in trolls, those kinds of antagonistic behaviors, oh, well, that's beyond the pale, that's unacceptable, that's aggressive, that's problematic. But then when we see it in sort of smaller iterations in other contexts, well, that's just how we communicate. How else are we going to argue? But it's normalized in these other contexts. And so what the book is trying to do is really call attention to those points of overlap. Trolls are not why we can't have nice things. These cultural tropes are why we can't have nice things. Trolls just happen to be the grotesque extension of things that we've normalized as being natural and necessary and sometimes even desirable. So to deal with the troll problem is not to simply build a better algorithm for figuring out how to ban them from different sites. Again, we would be so lucky if that were our only issue. We have to figure out, how do we rethink how we think, how we talk to each other, how we engage with each other, and how to be respectful at the cultural level in embodied spaces?
You've spent a lot of times in this troll culture, and I guess you've sort of moved up a step, if you will, in the, you know, evil comments on the internet, to now you're looking at, I would say it's sort of the snarky level of the internet, where you have sites that are basically mocking political discourse, the sites where it's so bad it's good meme. What are you investigating now?
I still am invested in conversations about antagonistic online speech. I tend to frame those conversations that I'm more interested in online harassment than trolling. Trolling tends to make it sound like it's playful, and the problem is that it's not for the targets, right? So thinking about online harassment more broadly, which means you've got to think about free speech online comment moderation policy. So that's one branch that I have remained in. But the book that I'm working on currently with my co-author Ryan Milner from the College of Charleston, that book is titled Between Play and Hate. And it's going to be looking at behaviors online that are not entirely harmless, that maybe there's some consent problems, you know, that it's not all cooperative, it's not everybody's having a great time. But it's also not hate. It's not explicitly damaging. It's somewhere in between, and how you would characterize those behaviors often depend on where you're standing in relation to them.
You are on the political spectrum. Yeah,
right. So yeah. We're looking at fundamentally ambivalent behaviors, and we're approaching it from the lens of folklore, identity play, audience participation, humor, and antagonism. So all of those different areas, you have a lot of really ambivalent behavior that, again, can often be really funny if you're not the target. Exactly. But if you are the target, maybe you would feel a little bit differently. At the same time, it's not explicitly harassing. It just is behavior that would be really difficult otherwise to sort of describe and wrap your head around. So our approach is to put these behaviors in a wider humanities context and try to make sense of them, not just in terms of how they unfold online, but what's the cultural and historical and technological precedent for these kinds of behaviors.
No, we wish you success with that. Whitney Phillips, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Whitney Phillips is an assistant professor of literary studies at Mercer University and author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. She'll be a guest of the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities here at the University of Tulsa, speaking on LOLing at Tragedy, Facebook Trolls and Memorial Pages. That lecture is free to the public this evening at 7 o'clock in Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.